Good morning to each one present this morning, and greetings in the name of our Savior, the one that was actually a part of the creation that Brother Steve was talking about. By Him, all things were created. And so it's good to be together in the house of the Lord, and glad for the presence of each one. Wants you to feel at home here this morning. Several months ago, I was reading in my Bible reading, I was reading through the book of Job. And you know the account of Job. I'm not going to go a lot into that this morning, refer to a few things. But when I got to the 38th through the 41st chapters, where God speaks, I was just really impressed and amazed again at the things that God had to say to Job and his three friends. And it just struck me how God was trying to portray the things that He has made, and the things that He has done, and the systems that He has put in place in this earth. And these are the things that, as He looks down on the earth, that He sees as important proofs of His existence. And so I've entitled the message this morning, God's Proofs of His Own Existence. And so my desire this morning in this message is that we might get a small glimpse of the greatness of God. And I know that there's no way that I can convey this in a way really that should be. I guess these ideas and this message have been incubating for months, and it needs years yet to incubate further. But we want to share what we can here this morning. Suppose that you were asked to prove to an unbeliever that there is a God, and that this God created the world, and that He created it in 6 days, and how do you go about it? You know, I think I'm speaking this morning to, by and large, almost exclusively to a group of believers. But if this whole church was packed full of unbelievers, agnostics, atheists, how would we go about to portray that this God that we serve is real? You know, I believe that there are proofs of God in creation. In fact, I don't think one can really prove the existence of God without referring to an understanding. No, I shouldn't say understanding, but referring to creation. So how would you go about it? Would you talk about the rotations of the earth and how the sun comes up in the morning, goes down at night, like Brother Steve was talking about? Would you mention that all of life is dependent on water, and this is one planet where there is water that sustains life? Would you mention the vast expanse of space and how there are heavenly bodies that stay in their courses and do not deviate, and they've been constant for millenniums, and people have used them as locators where they are on the earth? Or maybe you would talk about plant life and some of the beautiful flowers that we see about us these days. Or there would be the birds and the animals and the creatures in the sea. And then there's another whole field of our human bodies and how they're marvelously made and how each part has a purpose for the function. A number of years ago, I was assigned a subject at another locality. I think I gave some of that here. But the subject was How Great Thou Art. And in trying to think about that, I tried to come up with a few what I thought were interesting proofs of God as a creator. I dug around and found some notes on that, and I think I'm going to just take the time to read just a few notes that I would have had. That would have been about 7 years ago. And these are some things that I found of interest that to me are so astounding and so unusual to think that God would have made animals and other things in this way. So let me just read here. First is the bombarder beetle. It uses a unique defense system by mixing chemicals that explode. The bubbling liquid that comes squirting out is 212 degrees Fahrenheit, which is boiling. If the beetle would fire it all at one time, the force would be enough to make the beetle explode. However, slow motion photography has revealed that the beetle actually sets off a stream of approximately 1,000 tiny explosions. This enables the beetle to stay on its feet while warding off would-be attackers. This is a creature that God has made. Shouldn't it prove to us that there is an intelligent, more than an intelligent design, there is a God. All right. Another thing is a giraffe. It has a amazing circulatory system. It has a heart that weighs about 22 pounds, and it must double the blood pressure of the average large animal in order to get blood to the brain. So it takes a big heart. It takes a lot of pressure to get blood up to the brain. The problem arises when the giraffe wants to get a drink. When the giraffe would lean down to get a drink, all the blood would rush to its brain, almost certainly causing death. In the upper neck, the giraffe has a complex pressure regulation system. This regulating system has valves that close off as the giraffe leans over, causing the blood flow to decrease. The system must reverse when the giraffe puts its head up, or it would faint from loss of blood to the head. Now, you know, if I would have been the creator, I don't think I'd have thought of that. But God never come to the point where he said, you know, I just didn't think of that. It was all perfect. The woodpecker makes a living by hitting his head on a tree. This would kill any other bird, but the woodpecker is especially designed for the job. He has an extra tough skull, a cushion of shock-absorbing tissue for his brain, special claws and tough tail feathers for stability, and a very strong beak. So now, he can drill holes fast enough that it sounds like a machine gun. Between each strike, he opens his eyes, aims, and hits directly on his target, or the force of an off-center blow may wrench the cover off his brain. However, he still has a problem of getting the bugs once the holes are drilled. He has a very long, sticky tongue. The tongue is just right so that the bugs stick to it, but it doesn't stick to his mouth. Also, the tongue is too long to go down its throat, so instead it slips into a muscular sheath that wraps around the skull, under the scalp, and inserts into the right nostril. God made these creatures. But you know, when God was talking to Job, he didn't talk about the giraffe or the woodpecker or the bombarding beetle or the fairy fly. Have you ever heard of the fairy fly? The smallest insect, you can't even see it. It's 1/125th of an inch long. It's so small you can't even see it. And yet it functions like a regular insect. Well, and then we could go to the vast expanse of space. I don't think I'll do that. But in the book of Job, we find that God has another set of his creation that he would like for man to notice. And apparently they are some of them, or probably all of them, are they crown his creation, and he looks with satisfaction and pleasure upon that which he has made. We know that in the book of Job, Satan wanted and challenged God to test his servant Job. Could he withstand the test of losing all of his earthly possessions and his family and eventually his health? Worst kind of skin disease imaginable. And we know how that there were three friends who came to visit Job, supposedly to comfort him. And they, when they saw him, they could hardly believe it. They were speechless for 7 days as they sat there and observed the misery of this man. And there was a lot of conversation back and forth. These three friends, if you want to call them friends, Job called them miserable comforters, they were convinced that Job's problems were caused by some sin in his life. And Job constantly affirmed. He said, I'm not aware of any. I realize that I'm human, but I do not have sin in my life. So then why would he suffer deteriorating health as he did? Why would he suffer loss of possessions? There surely must be some cause. And Job cried out. He said, oh, if there was a daysman, if there was somebody that could stand between me and God and could explain all these things. And there was a fourth, Elihu, I believe, that came in, and he was going to try to be that daysman. But he was also accusing Job. During all this discourse, and all of this, shall we say, spinning of wisdom that it seemed like there was in the chapters, there was a silent listener. And this listener was God, the Sovereign One. You know, I have to wonder, when He listens to what we have to say, when we think we have something pretty intelligent and wise to say, does God just shake His head and say, He doesn't really know what He's talking about? But anyhow, God was a silent listener. And then out of a whirlwind, God spoke, and He said, who is this that darkeneth counsel by words without knowledge? Oh, what a rebuke. There were those who was darkening the counsel by words without knowledge. Ah, so they sit up and they take notice. And surely now God has the answers to all of their questions. Why does man suffer? What sense can we make out of all that Job went through? And so they listened. But God did not address that at all. In fact, today we wish He would have. Why didn't God say why mankind suffers and why there's sickness and death and losses and, well, you name it. But instead, He challenges Job and his three friends with questions concerning His creative acts and His sustaining abilities and His sovereignty. And He asks many, many questions. One writer that I read there said there's 77 questions. And many of them are rhetorical questions that really cannot be answered. Man cannot answer that. Let's put it that way. Only the One that made the world and its intricate workings knows the answers to these questions. And we're going to look at some of these. You know, I'm not an astrologist to understand about all the heavenly realms with the stars and the galaxies and the constellations. Neither am I a botanist to understand the various things concerning plant life. I'm not a zoologist that has taken a real interest in all the animals in the world. I'm not a hydrologist to understand how the water cycles keeps the earth hydrated. I'm not a meteorologist that understands all the weather patterns. These various experts have invested years of study and observation in their given fields of interest, and yet have much more to learn. They still don't know all about it. You take a meteorologist, I'm sure that there's quirks, if you want to put quirks of weather that I just wasn't expecting that. Didn't know that would take place this way. But God is all of these and more because He made them. He understands them. And He uses these examples to show that He is all-powerful, that He is all-knowing, and that, shall we say, things are not out of control. Turn with me to Job 38. Job 38, I'm going to read the first three verses here to begin with. Got the wrong book here. All right. Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, "Who is this that darkness counsel by words without knowledge? Gird up now thy loins like a man, for I will demand of thee, and answer thou me." And I'm going to read verse 4 also. "Where wast thou when I laid the foundations of the earth? Declare if thou hast understanding." And so these men had been talking. I don't know how long this took, whether it was, maybe it was a better part of a day, maybe there was a couple days involved, but they were talking. And God said, "If you have so much understanding, I'd like to ask you some questions and just see how deep your knowledge is." And so he goes on and he talks about the earth and the sea and the sun and the world of the dead and the light and darkness and weather and constellations. Hasn't even gotten to anything that lives yet. These are all inanimate objects. Basically, chapter 38 is that. So I'm going to take the time here to read chapter 38 and give just a few comments. Obviously cannot cover this in depth. But I can read verses 4 to 7, and we see here the earth's foundations. "Where wast thou when I laid the foundations of the earth? Declare if thou hast understanding. Who hath laid the measures thereof, if thou knowest? Or who hath stretched the line upon it? Whereupon are the foundations thereof fastened? Or who laid the cornerstone thereof? When the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy." Where were you, Job, when all this took place? You know so much. You've just been talking and talking and talking about these things. Where were you? What's the cornerstone of the earth? Where are the foundations? You know, there were a lot of ideas in the past of, you know, maybe an idea that the earth was held up by an elephant or a turtle or whatever. But those were theories. But these are questions of which Job had no answer. This morning stars is interesting. When the morning stars sang together, I would assume, and maybe you would interpret this differently, I would interpret this to be probably the angels that would have sang at the time of the creation of the earth. In fact, I'd like to read just a couple short passages in Psalms. Psalms 148, verses 2 and 3 says, "Praise ye Him, all His angels. Praise ye Him, all His hosts. Praise ye Him, sun and moon. Praise Him, all ye stars of light." And so it talks about praise of the heavenly hosts and the angels. And then going to back to Psalm 65, verses 9 to 13. "Thou visitest the earth and waterest it, thou greatly enrichest it with the river of God, which is full of water. Thou preparest them corn when thou hast provided for it. Thou waterest the ridges thereof abundantly, thou settlest the furrows thereof, thou makest it soft with showers, thou blessest the springing thereof. Thou crownest the year with thy goodness, and thy paths drop fatness. They drop upon the pastures of the wilderness, and the little hills rejoice on every side. The pastures are clothed with flocks. The valleys are also covered over with corn. They shout for joy. They also sing." The thought here is the wonders, the beauty of the creation of the earth. How the earth brings forth abundantly. The pastures and the valleys, they shout for joy, because of the God that has made them. All right. Now, let's go back to Job 38. I'd like to read verses 8 to 11. And we have here the sea. "Or who shut up the sea with doors when it break forth as if it had issued out of the womb? When I made the cloud the garment thereof, and the thick darkness a swaddling band for it, and break up for it my decreed place, and set bars and doors, and said, Hitherto shalt thou come, but no further, and here shall thy proud waves be stayed." The water being shut up behind doors Perhaps this is referring to the time prior to the flood, I'm not sure, where the I can't get the term now, but where the waters of the deep came forth. And he talks about clouds which hold water. And he talks about the sea being limited. I'm going to read Jeremiah 5. This is of interest to me. Jeremiah 5:22, that says, "Fear ye not me, saith the Lord. I will not tremble at my presence, which have placed the sand, or will ye not tremble at my presence, which have placed the sand for the bound of the sea by a perpetual decree that it cannot pass it. For though the waves are of toss themselves, yet they cannot prevail. Though they roar, yet they cannot pass over it." I'm sure most of us have stood on the shore of the Pacific Ocean. And you stand there on the ocean, or on the beach. And these waves just come rolling in, and you'd think they were going to just come on and cover you up, but you know, it just, they diminish, and pretty soon they are not anymore. It says, though they toss themselves, they can't prevail. Though they roar, they cannot pass. He says, "I have placed the sand for the bound of the sea by a perpetual decree." We notice here, verse 11, God talks to the sea. He says, you can come, but no further. And here your proud waves will be stayed. All right, then let's go to verses 12 to 15. We find the morning or the dawn. It's very interesting, I think, to go out early in the morning and just watch the quiet reemergence of the day as the light comes. Verse 12. Let's see. Yes. "Hast thou commanded the morning since thy days, and caused the day spring to know his place, that it might take hold of the ends of the earth, that the wicked might be shaken out of it? It is turned as clay to the seal, and they stand as a garment. And from the wicked their light is withholden, and the light arm shall be broken." It seems that God is saying that there is wickedness in darkness. Jesus said that there is condemnation to the sinners, and that light has come into the world, and men love darkness rather than light because their deeds were evil. And here he says that the wicked, verse 13, that the wicked might be shaken out of it. And so when light comes, it brings to into focus the evil that's being done at the dark time, and the wicked scurry for cover. I don't know if this is an appropriate illustration or not, but it's something I thought about. When I was a boy, I used to enjoy going with one of my best friends, John Stutzman, to his place, Merle Stutzman's place. And they had a barn on there, and in that haymow was just full of rats. And we would really enjoy creeping up there in the dark and turn on the light and just watch the rats scatter. And so I think maybe that's a little bit what God is saying here, that when the light comes on in the daytime, all the sinners need to find a place of cover. All right. Verses 16 to 18. It talks about the sea. "Hast thou entered into the springs of the sea, or hast thou walked in the search of the depth? Have the gates of death been opened unto thee? Or hast thou seen the doors of the shadow of death? Hast thou perceived the breath of the earth? Declare if thou knowest it all. Job, tell me, have you seen this? Do you understand? Do you understand death? Do you understand the vast expanse of the earth? The springs of the sea?" All right, let's go into the weather here. And this is, there's a lot of things mentioned. Snow, hail, lightning, wind, rain, thunderstorms, dew, ice, frost. I'm going to read verses 22 to 30, and then from 31 to 33. Hast thou entered into the treasures of the snow, or hast thou seen the treasures of the hail, which I have reserved against the time of trouble, against the day of battle and war? By what way is the light parted, which scattereth the east wind upon the earth? Who hath divided the watercourse for the overflowing of waters, or a way for the lightning of thunder, to cause it to rain on the earth, where no man is, on the wilderness wherein there is no man, to satisfy the desolate and waste ground, and to cause the bud of the tender herb to spring forth? Hath the rain a father, or who hath begotten the drops of dew? Out of whose womb came the ice and the hoary frost of heaven? Who gendereth it? The waters are hid as with a stone, and the face of the deep is frozen. Very interesting ways of talking about these things. Let's see, it talks here about hailstones. Trying to think, notice where that is here. How that God fights with them. I don't see her right now, but anyhow, in Joshua we find that God fought against the enemies of Israel with hailstones. All right, going down to verse 34 to 38. Canst thou lift up thy voice to the clouds, that abundance of waters may cover thee? Canst thou send lightnings, that they may go and say unto thee, Here we are? Who hath put wisdom in the inward parts, or who hath given understanding to the heart? Who can number the clouds in wisdom, or who can stay the bottles of heaven when the dust groweth into hardness and the clods cleave fast together? And so there's some more things here in relation to the weather. He's basically saying, do the lightning bolts report to you? Do you have anything to say about when they come, when they go? Verse 37 here. Who can stay the bottles of heaven? Another translation just puts it this way. Who can step over the water jars of the heavens? All right, then backing up to verses 31 to 33. And here's something I feel I don't know a lot about, the constellations. In fact, in chapter 9, Job mentions these constellations. Canst thou bind the sweet influence of Pleiades, or loose the bands of Orion? Canst thou bring forth Maseroth in his season, or canst thou guide Arcturus with his sons? Knowest thou the ordinances of heaven? Canst thou set the dominion thereof in the earth? If you remember when Morris Yoder was here some time back, and he showed us the pictures that he had of the great expanse of the universe, and the beautiful constellations, but galaxies and so on, and all the truths that go along with that, it was amazing. Really enjoyed that. So God talked about all these things. He talked about the earth and the weather and the stars and the sea and all that, and hadn't even spoken anything yet about anything living. He hadn't even talked about a giraffe or a bombardier beetle. And wouldn't these inanimate aspects of creation be proof enough? But now for greater proof, God mentions a few living creatures. And before we go into that, I'm going to go back to chapter 12. And here Job himself refers to animals as proof of God. Chapter 12, verses 7 to 12 says, But ask now the beasts, and they shall teach thee, and the fowls of the air, and they shall tell thee. Or speak to the earth, and it shall teach thee, and the fishes of the sea shall declare unto thee. Who knoweth not in all these that the hand of the Lord hath wrought this, in whose hand is the soul of every living thing, and the breath of all mankind? Doth not the ear try the words, and the mouth taste his meat? With the ancient is wisdom, and in length of days understanding. And so he says, you know, ask about the beasts and the birds and the various things here, and they will teach thee. And so God goes into some of these, and I'm not going to have time to cover this in detail, but let me just mention some of these. The first part here in chapter 38, verses 39 and 40, he talks about the lion, the king of the beasts. Wilt thou hunt the prey for the lion, or fill the appetite of the young lions, when they crouch in their dens and abide in the covert to lie in wait? Now, God knew some things about the characteristics of the lion. And from what I read, a young lion, it talks about the young lion here, the young lion does not have the strength or the stamina or the swiftness to go out and overtake a prey like a adult lion would. And so they crouch in a hiding place and wait till some prey comes by that they can easily spring out and get. And so it says here, they couch in their dens and abide in the covert to lie in wait. God knew what he was talking about. The raven, verse 41, who provideth for the raven his food. When his young ones cry to God, they wander for lack of meat. I don't know if a raven or a crow is the hungriest bird around or not, but they sure make a lot of racket if they don't get enough to eat. They are mentioned a couple of other times in Psalm 147, verse 9. He giveth to the beast his food, and to the young ravens which cry. Kind of the same thought as here. Also Jesus said, consider the ravens, for they neither sow nor reap, which neither have storehouse nor barn, and God feedeth them. Going into the next chapter then, the first four verses we have the wild goat, or you might say the mountain goat. If I understand right, there's two kinds of wild goats, and the one that this is likely talking about is one that has rough, large, curved horns. And it's shy, and it's wild, and it's difficult to approach, and it inhabits rocks and desolate tracts of land. And man really does not know a great lot about this wild goat. But God does. And so with an animal that's so wild, how could man observe its life cycles, such as the birth of young? How could anyone but the Creator know the time of its birth and its habits? Keep that in mind as I read these first four verses. Knowest thou the time when the wild goats of the rock bring forth, or canst thou mark when the hinds do calf? Canst thou number the months that they fulfill, or knowest thou the time when they bring forth? They bow themselves or bring forth the young ones. They cast out their sorrows. The young ones are in good liking. They grow up with corn. They go forth and return not unto them. And then we have the next section, the wild ass or the donkey. And something I read there was that people have taken a colt of the wild ass and tried to tame it and domesticate it, and it can't be done. It's just within them to be free. Free of restraint. Verse 7 here says he... Well, let me read verses 5 to 8. Who hath sent out the wild ass free, or who hath loosed the bands of the wild ass? Whose house I have made the wilderness, and the barren land his dwellings. He scorneth the multitude of the city, neither regardeth he the cry of the driver. The range of the mountains is his pasture, and he searcheth after every green thing. Verse 7, he scorns the multitude. He doesn't want to be around people. And he's not going to be domesticated. He's not going to be tamed. He doesn't regard the crying of the driver that wants to do that. Okay, then we have verses 9 to 12, the unicorn. That's maybe a little bit of a puzzle. What's a unicorn? In my reading, it appears to be a wild ox, which is now extinct, a very large animal, a bull, you might say, that you want to stay out of its way because it would just tear up about anything that comes along its way. Again, a wild animal that cannot be domesticated. So much different than the ox that plows and works hard for his master. Let me read verses 9 to 12. Will the unicorn be willing to serve thee, or abide by thy crib? Canst thou bind the unicorn with his band in the furrow, or will he harrow the valley after thee? Is he going to pull the plow for you? No. Wilt thou trust him because his strength is great, or wilt thou leave thy labor to him? Wilt thou believe him that he will bring home thy seed and gather it into thy barn? You going to believe him that he's going to work for you? No, he's too wild for that. And then we find the the ostrich. I'm going to run out of time here. I don't think I'll go a lot into that. But the ostrich is kind of an interesting creature. It says how she covers her eggs with sand, and it forgets that a foot may crush them. Verse 15, a wild beast may break them. Verse 16, she hardeneth her heart against her young. I was going to read just a little something that I found here. It says there's an Arab proverb, as stupid as an ostrich, which the Arabs justify on five grounds. This is why they say as stupid as an ostrich. One, the ostrich, they say, will swallow iron, stones, leaden bullets, and other things which injure and sometimes prove fatal to it. Two, when hunted, it thrusts its head into a bush and imagines that the hunter does not see it. Three, it allows itself to be captured by transparent devices. Four, it neglects its eggs. Five, its head is small and contains but a small quantity of brains. To these grounds, I may add that in the South African ostrich farms, the birds allow themselves to be confined within a certain space by a fence of sticks and string raised about a foot from the ground. They seem to think they can't step over it. So that's some things in relation to the ostrich. But verse 17 says, God has deprived her of wisdom. But what time she lifts herself on high, she scorneth the horse and his rider. In other words, she can run. She can run fast. All right, then the next passage here is about the horse, and this is the only domesticated animal that God talks about here in Job. And it's a vivid description of a horse that is impatient to rush into the battle. And verse 24 says, he swallows the ground with fierceness and rage. I think I'll take the time to read here verses 19 to 25. Hast thou given the horse strength? Hast thou clothed his neck with thunder? Canst thou make him afraid as a grasshopper? The glory of his nostrils is terrible. He paweth in the valley and rejoiceth in his strength. He goeth on to meet the armed men. He mocketh at fear and is not affrighted, neither turneth he back from the sword. The quiver rattleth against him, the glittering spear and the shield. He swalloweth the ground with fierceness and rage, neither believeth he that it is the sound of the trumpet. He saith among the trumpets, ha ha, and he smelleth the battle afar off, the thunder of the captains and the shouting. I guess that's it there. All right. So the horse is a tremendous beast, and especially it was so in battle. And God takes note of that. All right. Then verse 26, the hawk. One thing I'd like to point out there, just for verse 26, does the hawk fly by the wisdom and stretch her wings toward the south? It seems that God here is referring to the migration of the birds, stretching her wings toward the south. There's few things in nature that's more remarkable than the instinct of migratory birds. And then the last part of the chapter, we have the eagle. She dwelleth and abideth on the rock, upon the crag of the rock, in the strong place. From thence she seeketh the prey, and her eyes behold afar off. Her young ones also suck up blood, and where the slain are, there is she. The eagle, they soar to great heights, and they live on the high crags, and they have very keen eyesight. Is there any reason why we use the term an eagle eye? You can just see very much. Well, it would seem that God has made his point by now. He's looked at the earth, the weather. He's looked at all these animals. But there's two other creatures that he describes in great detail. The behemoth and the leviathan. And maybe I just about as soon stop right here, go home, because I can't explain them, obviously. There are no animals that I know of that living today that fit the description. This behemoth, and I'm not going to take the time to read it. You can read that on your own. But many commentators would suggest the elephant, the hippopotamus, the rhinoceros, but none of them really fit. I'll just leave it at that. It does seem that there may, and we don't have any of those living today, but there may be some dinosaurs that would have fit this description. I was looking in the Wikipedia, the Brachiosaurus dinosaur is estimated to have weighed anywhere from 38 to 62 tons, so that would be a huge animal. The Leviathan is obviously a sea creature. Some would say it's a crocodile. And yet, according to this chapter, it can't be controlled by man. It can hardly be caught or whatever. And there's lots of crocodiles in captivity. So it about has to be some sea monster of some kind. And maybe here again, that it's extinct one. I don't know. There's many legends of ferocious sea monsters, some even today. And so obviously I have not studied all these things in depth. It would take a lifetime to do that. But I find this of interest. And I'm impressed with the various aspects of creation, the cycles of the earth and the examples of the animals that God used to prove His existence and His power and His sovereignty. And I just felt like that there's so much here that we need to consider. So how did Job feel about this? I think that his response should be very similar to what our response would be as we look at these things that God has said about His creation. Chapter 42, first 6 verses. Then Job answered the Lord and said, I know that thou canst do everything, and that no thought can be withholden from thee. Who is he that hideth counsel without knowledge? Therefore have I uttered that I understood not, things too wonderful for me which I knew not. Hear, I beseech thee, and I will speak. I will demand of thee, and declare thou unto me. I have heard of thee by the hearing of the ear, but now mine eye seeth thee. Wherefore I abhor myself, and repent in dust and ashes. This Job, who declared again and again that he had not sinned, that he did not have sin in his life, he comes to the point of abhorring himself. He comes to the point of repenting. And he says, I have been speaking. I've said things. But I had counsel without knowledge. But he said, Now I see thee. Now I understand. And so we know how that God restored Job back to his... Actually, He gave him twice as much as what he had before. And so I trust that this, in a small way, will help us to worship God, to be more mindful of Him. And that we might keep this in mind, that God has proofs that He is interested in, proofs of His own existence. Let's have a closing song.